Monday, July 1st. Some days have their harvest of hope. This one did, with the signing of a very special treaty in the East Room at 11:30. First, in the morning, I recorded, and then went to the Lincoln Sitting Room, my now familiar meeting place, to see Simone and Perry Wolf, a TV documentary producer, who did Mrs. Kennedy's walk through the White House. Frank Stanton had suggested that they might want to film my very different walk through the family quarters, second floor of the White House, which would show how this house is used and lived in by one family in the mid-1960s. It was a curiously deflating meeting. Mr. Wolf had already been with Simone and had seen the rough movies done by the White House staff here of the Treaty Room, and he had read my script, the spontaneous talk, about the other rooms. I had the feeling that he did not think much of it and was reluctant to engage in the project. We ended on the note that his time was compellingly full until September 1st, and that if he were going to do it right, and he did want to do it, he said, he would like to write out a proposal, and we'd plan to do it in September. I'd rather do it the homemade variety than not at all. And its being on the air is not what matters to me. It's being there for me to remember and look at, and all our friends, and the Johnson Library, and maybe scholars of the future. For this personal, warm, home part of the White House is not known. This would be a first in its way, a very small way, granted. Just before 11:30, I went down to meet Lyndon at the elevator, and we marched into the East Room with that feeling of something momentous happening that has so often accompanied me into this stateliest room of all. Mr. Wolf was somewhere in the audience. And so surprisingly was Virginia Howard Hamilton and her husband and children. Years ago, she'd been married to Leo's son, who had died, and her family had been a part of my childhood and growing up years. So today, as so often, simple in the sweet, met with a momentous and world-shaking in this house. It was a dramatic setting. The room was jammed full of spectators, and there was as much press and TV as could crowd in. A table from the Treaty Room had been brought down, and there sat the Soviet Ambassador Dobrynin, and then Britain's Sir Patrick Dean, and then William C. Foster, our Director of Arms Control and Disarmament, and then Dean Rusk, and then Lyndon took his seat. And the full battery of the cameras was upon them, but all across the whole east wall of the East Room were representatives of other nations. Dean Rusk talked, and then Sir Patrick Dean, and then Dobrynin. There's always a little rustle of excitement, seems to me, when he rises. And then Lyndon. He said, "This treaty is the most important international agreement since the beginning of the nuclear age." The gist of it was that the United States and Britain and the Soviet Union, as well as 58 non-nuclear nations, signed the treaty to prohibit the spread of nuclear weapons, and it had been in negotiation for 6 years. And dramatically, the same sort of ceremony was going on at the same time in Moscow and in London. But at the end came the most momentous statement. Lyndon announced that the United States and the Soviet Union have agreed to begin talks in the nearest future on the limitation and reduction of offensive nuclear missiles and anti-missile systems. He had first broached the subject in a private letter to Khrushchev in January 64. There had been an exchange ever since. And finally, now, a breakthrough. When and where the talks would start, we do not know. But at least a beginning has been made. And maybe, in years to come, we'll look back on this day as the turning point in the nuclear decades. He took out some insurance. Discussion of this most complex subject will not be easy. We have no illusions that it will be. I know the stubborn, patient persistence it has required to get this far. I know the difficulties that lie ahead. I know the fears, suspicions, and anxieties we shall have to overcome. But still, it was a moment of hope. When it was over, we went into the Blue Room for a receiving line, and all the ambassadors filed by first, with congratulations and a feeling of warmth and of some accomplishment. And as Arthur and Dorothy Goldberg came by, she said, "Today was worth leaving the court for," and I felt a pang. George McGee, fresh back from Germany, came beaming down the line. I thanked him for sending me the treaty, a copy of it, between Baron von Moisebach and his Germans and the Indians at Fredericksburg. And he said Farmer's Delight was beautiful and wouldn't we come out. I hugged Virginia and all her family when they came by. And then we all went into the state dining room for refreshments. Lyndon had gone upstairs, the Central American ambassadors, and Covey Oliver and Angie Duke, but I circulated for a good 20 minutes until the guests were drifting away. And then, close to one, went upstairs for a hamburger on a tray in my room. And then, once more down to the Blue Room. How quickly this house has to change its face for different meetings. To receive the International Consumers Committee, representatives from many countries gathered here to discuss consumer problems. Betty Furness as their Washington hostess. And then, back to the state dining room once more for refreshments and mingling. Usually, I try to put myself into a receiving line with all the vivacity and outgoing warmth and interest I can. Finally, there comes a time when you are a robot. Because there were so many whose languages I could not speak, whose problems under discussion I did not know about, I found myself being simply mechanical and left with the dissatisfied feeling that I had not been a good hostess. And then, down to the basement for a very important meeting with Bess and Jim Ketchum and Mr. West, and a young lady who had done an enormous lot of research. We were in the room where Lucy's wedding presents had been spread out in the summer of 66, and Linda's in December of 67, and now there were spread out the 50 dessert plates to go with the Johnson China service, and an imposing array of botanical books, ancient and modern, rare and expensive, and every day like our little roadside flowers of Texas. We took the plates alphabetically and looked at several prints of each state's flower, the violet, the goldenrod, the dogwood. The hardest of all was the District of Columbia's American Beauty Rose, because we are attempting to make this delicate, airy, and elegant. We labored for nearly 2 hours, debating, choosing, changing. But most of the credit goes to Bess and to the young woman who had done the enormous amount of research of collecting these books and standing by our elbow, turning from the rhododendron in one book to the rhododendron in another book, and still another. The dessert plates have turned out to be a job. If we can get them all hand-painted, if the results turn out as pretty as most of these botanical prints, it will be a proud day. The rest of the afternoon, I worked with Ashton and recorded, and then went to the bowling lanes for 2 quick games, and then back upstairs and changed into my beige lace to go to Pearl Mester's for just a brief 30-minute drop-in, a cocktail before dinner. She'd written us that she was having a small private party in honor of Tom and Mary Clark. When I'd stopped by Lyndon's office, he had had a stack of work and didn't see how he could possibly leave until 9, which would be too late. So I went alone, and as I walked into the Sheraton Park, there, private or no, was a photographer and Dorothy McCardle. My heart sank. It's so pleasant to be able to go out in the evening, quite privately, just for fun. It was a small gathering in Pearl's apartment. The Dale Millers, the Jake Pickles, Mindy and Hale, Senator Ellender. I circled the room, had a drink, some light and pleasant talk, and then left before I thought it was time for them to go into dinner. Dorothy McCardle and the photographer were still there. Back at the White House, I had a rub. And in the middle of it, Lyndon came in, close to 10 o'clock. But that hostile instrument, the telephone, summoned him before we could go to the table, and it was nearly 11 when we had dinner, and then to bed. The second most important news of the day was that Linda heard from Chuck, her first letter in 2 weeks, a short one. He said he had returned from a mission to find a big stack of mail. He had only time to read 2 or 3 letters, write her this short one, stuff a few more into his pockets, and leave on another mission. She has been cheerful, normal, busy.